Father in the heavens, please, you know how unworthy I feel to speak before your saints. I join with my brothers and sisters here in Yahshua's name, asking that every word that I speak that is foreign to the spirit of truth or untrue, cause it to fall to the ground unnoticed. But every word, Father, that is ordained of heaven, that is true and speaks to your will for us, Yahweh, please grant that those words sink deep into our heart and bear good fruit. Committing this entire service into your hands, in Yahshua the Messiah, we pray. Amen. Well, brothers and sisters, I'm Brother Michael Bannock from the Chicago area. Every blessing of Yahshua be upon you. I happen to be visiting Holt Summit at this time of the year. It just seemed like a good idea to get away from Chicago and spend this winter dip with the Brotherhood. My sincerest shalom to those of you who are listening on the audio ministry, such as the CDs or downloading on the internet. Likewise, my sincerest shalom to those of you who are watching now or else tapping into the archive videos. I'm going to be doing something I did at the feast. Maybe I'll make this a habit. It seemed to work last time. Because I haven't had a chance to print out my notes, I'll just put them on the screen of the computer here. And if you want to see what my notes say, they're up ahead there. But this is not to be interpreted as this is not Brother Michael's PowerPoint or presentation. This is just my notes. And some of these things will look cryptic to you. I may skip over some things you see, and I may add things that you don't see. But those are my notes. The cameraman, I just ask you not to... It's not meant for you to focus on that, but you can turn the camera up there on occasion if you wish. Many years ago, I had been in a courting relationship with a beloved sister in the faith, and this was a very wise sister. And even though we concluded that Yahweh did not intend for us to be together, I drew an important lesson from that relationship. Now, keep in mind, I had only been baptized for maybe a few years, and she said to me the following. She said, Brother Michael, she said, nobody knows who you are. We don't know where you came from, what your beliefs are, what your practices are, what your habits are. We don't know anything about you. And this beloved sister was making a good point. How could I pursue a serious relationship with her if she had no basis for trusting me? And my feelings weren't hurt by that. I could see her point. And, every girl's different. Isn't it true, guys? Every girl's different. And this is one of those girls, she needed to know a guy for a long time before she could get serious with him. And not all women are like that. But I could understand her need for protection to have some confidence in dealing with me. You know, since that time, I have dedicated myself to building my trust within the Brotherhood, whereas that is where you're able to trust me. And it isn't like I carry it around on a big sign or a T-shirt that says, trust me on the back, but it just seemed to make a lot of sense. Yeah, how in the world can you accomplish anything in the faith? I mean, especially the quest for a life partner. How can you do that if you don't have a trustworthy reputation? So I'd actually put a lot of energy into this. I could spend a lot of time up here talking with you about things I've done to build that trust amongst us. Certainly building a reputation of good fruits is important. But for an example, one of the sisters here has information about job opportunities here in the Jefferson City area. And I'm seriously thinking of moving here if I can make it happen. Moving here from Chicago. Well, when I correspond with that sister by email, I always make sure that her husband is courtesy copied in those emails. I don't want to get the reputation of a guy who's sending emails to married women, you know, behind the husband's back, even if it's something as innocent as a quest for job information. And you married men, sometimes I'll forget that, but I'm very careful how I talk to married women and married women in general. How I deal with the children when we sing at with the youth there at the feast. There is a great disinfectant for evil, and it's a great way also to build trust. It's in John chapter 3. It's in verse 20. John 3, verse 20. For everyone that doeth evil hates the light, neither comes to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest that they are wrought in Yahweh. That's John chapter 3, verse 20. Yeah, I didn't give you a whole lot of time to turn there because it's not in the notes. But surely that has been a guiding principle in my life. I've had many of you brethren visit my home near Chicago. And you guys can confirm this after the meeting, but I tell people, look around. If you see anything in here that's foreign to Yahweh's spirit, let me know. And out it goes. And people can log on my computer. They can look at anything they want. I just don't care. The scriptures say that we are a living letter from the Messiah to the world around us. We've got to be subject to light, scrutiny, accountability. These things build trust. Well, in a recent series of events, there was a brother in the faith doing something that I thought was ill-conceived. And I asked him to stop. I said, you know, I can't make you stop. But, you know, if you keep this up, I'm going to have a hard time trusting you. And he looked back at me and he said, trust ye no man. He's quoting the Bible. And it shocked me because here I've been spending like the last, 25 years working on this. This is an active part of my devotional life, is to connect my heart with your hearts, bridges of friendship, fellowship, and trust. And some guy's looking back at me and says, well, trust ye no man. Did you know, since hearing that, I've tried to find that verse in the Bible, and many people quote that. I mean, if somebody's quoting a Bible verse, you'd like to trust that they're quoting the Bible. Ironically, I can't find that verse in the Bible. Me and Alan went looking for it earlier today. Brother Ken couldn't come up with anything, you know, asking him before services. But, you know, there really is no verse in the Bible that says, trust ye no man or trust no man. Numerous people quote that on the internet. They paraphrase it. They say, the Bible tells me, trust no man. But nobody can manage to find a verse that says explicitly that. What we're going to find as we go through this this discussion, and I'd like this to be a conversation starting now and at fellowship time, there are different levels of trust. There's different levels of mistrust. There's seasons to trust. There's seasons to not trust. There's just sort of different situations. And just to pluck a verse out and say, trust ye no man, well, that's not going to do justice to what we see in the scriptures. There are some Old Testament verses that talk about trust. Now here I got in my notes, 2 Kings chapter 18. This is a typical verse. This is not meant to be educational. It's just an example. Now, behold, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which, if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, unto all that trust him. You know, sometimes I like to do one-arm push-ups while I'm waiting in line at Burger King. You'll see me doing one-arm push-ups, and I'm leaning on the counter. But if I was to lean on Egypt like that, it would pierce through my hand, and I'd get hurt. There's a lot of verses like that in the Old Testament. And they speak to our inability to trust man for things we should be trusting Yahweh for, whether it be national security, eternal life, heavenly protection. There are other verses that talk about trusting Yahweh as opposed to man. Psalm 118, it is better to trust in Yahweh than to put confidence in man. That's a prophetic psalm. It speaks to the second coming. A lot of things today in the Bible study and in service that feed into this message. We sing Blessed Be He, that comes from Psalm 118. The psalm is an instruction to Israel to trust Yahweh and his Messiah rather than man. Psalm 146, put not your trust in princes. Well, it looks like I repeated a line there. But anyway, put not your trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help. His breath goeth forth, he returns to the earth, and that very day his thoughts perish. Yet be as he that hath the Elohim of Jacob for his help, whose hope is in Yahweh, his Elohim. A lot of verses like that in the Bible that talk about the need to trust Yahweh rather than man. But it's obvious, we talk about trusting Yahweh for things we would never look to man for. There's different kinds of trust, there's different things to trust people for. For example, if we go on a congregational outing like at the feast, let's suppose we're going to go hiking in the woods, and I jump in your vehicle to go, you know, to get me a ride there. I'm trusting you to get me there safely. Sometimes people worry about flying, you know, and on airplanes. And I keep reminding myself, well, the pilot wants to get home, you know. Now, it's not like I'm trusting him with my life, but I'm trusting him to do as good a job as he can. And he's highly motivated to get me home safely, too, because that's exactly what his goals are. There's different levels of trust in different situations. These three verses are the closest I could find to tell you to trust no man. And so I thought I'd throw them up there just for completeness. Jeremiah 9, verse 4, take ye heed every one of his neighbor, and trust ye not in any brother, for every brother will utterly supplant, and every neighbor will walk with slanders. Now these three verses I got up here in my notes, these are terrifying verses. They're very explicit about not trusting people. But if you look at the context, it's a context of national judgment on Israel, a total breakdown in the fabric of society. Micah 7, verse 5, trust ye not in a friend, put ye not confidence in a guide. Keep the doors of thy mouth from her that lieth in thy bosom. In other words, you can't even trust your wife. Things have broken down so bad. Now we know about the history of Israel when she faced her judgments. The land was filled with murder, iniquity, duplicity, moral impurity. When I was telling you not to trust man in these situations, I don't think they apply to you and us. We're already saved. We're already sanctified. We're covered by the blood of the Lamb. I don't see how that applies to us. Jeremiah 17, 5, thus saith Yahweh, cursed be the man that trusts in man, and maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departs from Yahweh. Now, in the time of Jeremiah, the Israelites had a problem. They were being invaded by Babylon, and they were seriously thinking, should we run to Egypt for help? And that was actually a common theme there in Jeremiah's time. Don't go to Egypt. Just give yourselves over to Babylonian captivity. Yahweh will take care of you there. There's a New Testament word for trust that I want to focus on. There's several words for trust. You can look them up at your leisure. And it's patho, the Greek concordance, Strong's number 3982. And it has a lot of different meanings. But the one thing that jumps out at you when you look at the uses of the verb, the word that is, there's an element of persuasion at play. One of the great best study guides you can get your hands on is the Englishman's Concordance of both the Greek and the Hebrew. Now, this is the Greek one. What you do is you look up the Strong's number, and it tells you all the different ways that a word is translated. And most of the time, it's translated persuade, but there's a significant number of times that it's translated trust. And we're going to focus on that word as we contemplate what the New Testament tells us about trust within the brotherhood. I need to establish the need for us to build bridges of trust with each other. And this may be obvious to some of you. You know, maybe you don't need to look at this stuff. But I feel challenged now to confirm with certainty that the Bible speaks about us trusting each other. First, there's verses that talk about trust in Yahweh. And it's first one here is 2 Corinthians 1:9. These are New Testament verses now. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves that we should not trust in ourselves, but in Elohim which raises the dead. Of course, we trust Yahweh for eternal life. I'm not going to trust you for that. Well, that's absurd on the face of it. Here's another one. Philippians 2:24. But I trust in Yahweh that I also myself shall come shortly. You hear Paul in this passage. He's talking about a visit he wants to make. And he's trusting in Yahweh that he'll be able to do that. Well, I know how he feels because, well, that's how I feel often when I come here. I'm trusting Yahweh to work that thing out. On my last visit, it almost didn't happen. But he's trusting Yahweh to make that stuff work out for him. Well, it turns out when the King James translators came to this word, patho, when it had to do with Yahweh, they translated it trust. But when it talked about our relationship to each other here in the New Covenant, was translated confidence. Now, I see here five verses that use the word confidence, but there's really only three of them. They're the ones I got in red here in my notes. There's three of them that use that same Greek word, 3892, patho. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 2, verse 3. And I wrote this same unto you, lest when I came, I should have sorrow from them of whom I ought to rejoice, having confidence in you all that my joy is the joy of you all. So, if I can clarify what he's saying there, he has the confidence that the joy in the brotherhood there at Corinth is the same joy he has, that they're going to rejoice over the same things, and that they share a common bond of faith. Galatians 5:10, I have confidence in you through Yahweh that you will be none otherwise minded, but that he that troubleth you shall bear his judgment whosoever. So he's expressing trust that they're going to be of one mind in dealing with there's some people there in Galatia who are trying to persuade them to become circumcised. And he's expressing confidence in their ability to handle that situation. In Philemon, he says, having confidence in thy obedience, I wrote unto thee, knowing that thou wilt also do more than I say. He's expressing trust in Philemon. Now, in that letter to Philemon, Paul was appealing for the release of one of his disciples. One of Philemon's slaves ran away, and Paul managed to find him and convert him. And Paul was asking that he would declare that runaway kid as a free man now. But he's saying, I trust you're going to do this at my request. It seems very reasonable, based on the scriptures, observation, real life, that we should have some level of trust in each other. Now, one of the key ideas in this Greek word that I chose is the idea of convincing or persuading. And over time, I will be convinced of your trustworthiness. Over time, you'll be persuaded of my trustworthiness. Some of us who have been around the block a few times can look back at various feasts where people would just drop in and demand microphone time. We don't know them, where they came from, who they are, nothing. But they want microphone time. They even made no investment in developing a reputation of good fruits. Well, I'm certainly not in a hurry for this. But I mean, for somebody to just drop in on a feast and demand microphone time, they're too much in a hurry. Why should we have trust in each other? You know, this is a subject I suppose could go on for a long time. And I'd like to just cover it in a short while up here. You know, one of the best reasons to have trust and develop trust in each other is so that we can do exploits. The concept of doing exploits comes from Daniel chapter 11, verse 32 and 33. And churches do wickedly against the covenant, shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that know their Elohim shall be strong and do exploits. Now you see the word exploits is in italics in your Bibles there. And that means the word exploits is not really there. The word do is there. Some of your translations render that they shall work effectively, or they shall be effective. Let's go to the next verse. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. That sounds like an exploit. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. You know, as we approach the end time, and I don't know when that's going to be. Even if the end time is not over the horizon, I know that it's going to happen in, let's say, two or three generations. I mean, you just see the way the world's going. So many prophetic trends are being fulfilled right before our very eyes. Even if it's not going to happen, like in my lifetime, I see it coming. And we should be preparing ourselves for that era when we do exploits and we work effectively. And we're going to be instructing many. And before this assembly can grow much larger, you have to make sure you are able to trust each other. We'll talk about some specific exploits that we will do, we must do. Here, marriage is an exploit. Remember, I started out with a story of a girl I was courting some time ago. She had a very good point there. Marriage is a lifetime exploit between two people. I don't mean they're exploiting each other. No, they're partnered together to do good exploits for each other and on behalf of the kingdom. Sometimes we'll engage in Bible projects, such as recordings, music, building the assembly hall. Sometimes there's short-term projects relative to the feast. Sometimes just getting to the feast is a project. How about evangelism? I remember once I was with a fellow who was evangelizing, and while he was speaking to this candidate for salvation, I was correcting the brother. Say, no, you shouldn't say it that way. And he later took me aside. He says, Michael, you're all wrong. He said, you should be praying for me while I'm witnessing to this stranger. He is right. He's right about that. I should be trusting him to express his faith in a way that Yahweh has given him. Another exploit might be volunteer night at YRM. Suppose Randy says, okay, we got to put stamps on the envelopes. Suppose he gives a head-high stack of envelopes to Brother Paul. He says, Brother Paul, I want you to put stamps on these envelopes. We're going to trust you, Paul, not to steal some of those stamps, right? We do volunteer night at YRM. A lot of things are on autopilot. We just sort of turn our back and let the other guy do his thing, and I do mine. We got to trust each other with this stuff. This seems kind of obvious after a while. We got to. How about the clean and unclean food stuff? You guys can come to my home anytime, read any label, ask me any questions. But I'm trusting you, and I dip my ladle into that yummy stuff that you girls bring for fellowship meal. I'm trusting you to bring clean food. The only time I'll question it is if there is a substantive area of uncertainty that very few people know about. For example, there was a time when many of us didn't know that a lot of soft drinks are colored red with cochineal, which is ground up bugs. And it was news that had spread through the fellowship. Now that's reasonable. If there's like a new thing hits the street and we didn't know we were being tricked, then of course it's reasonable to make inquiry. But I don't want you girls to ever have your feelings hurt if I ask a question, because there'll be a reasonable basis for that. But there's one area I want to talk about a lot, and that is end time survival. You know, even if the end time is not going to happen real soon, hard times may come. I'd like to share with you an end time riddle. I talk about this often over campfires, in after hours Sabbath discussions. And I don't claim to have the complete answer here, but it's something we should think about. Suppose we're in some kind of tribulation scenario, and we've decided to knit ourselves together and stick it out together. We may stay in one place. We may feel after prayer that Yahweh wants us to go to a certain place, but we're hanging together. And all of a sudden, somebody comes along and says, hey, I want to join you. I want to tag along. And we never heard of this person. Let's go a little farther. Suppose it's one of your unsaved friends or relatives. Is this the time for them to hop on board? Is this the time to jump on with us? For sure, they like the protection. They want the love, the provision that Yahweh's given us. But what are they going to do when they find out that all we have to eat is manna? What are they going to do when they find out that on certain days, holy time, we don't do certain things? I remember at the feast one year, a family came with some unsaved relatives, and some of them started fishing on Sabbath. You know, that was a sticky situation. Brother Randy handled it very well, I thought. But what are you going to do when there's a lot at stake? Tribulation scenario, end time scenario? What do you let strangers just come in? See, the reason you're uncomfortable with this is because they haven't earned your trust. You're not persuaded. in this hypothetical situation. Now, where I'm at right now, I lean against allowing strangers to tag along for a tribulation scenario or an end time scenario. I think a lot of trouble can emerge. If you look at the Old Testament, look up the mixed multitude, especially in the book of Numbers, they caused a lot of trouble. We want water, we want meat, we want this, we want that. And they stirred up the heart of the Israelites. And it made it harder for Moses to effectively pull off that exodus. What are you going to do in an end time scenario when unsaved friends and relatives want to tag along? Okay, I lean towards saying no. I'll tell you why in a bit. But I'm not going to answer the whole question now. But look, friends, even though I can't answer what we're going to do with unsaved friends and relatives who want to suddenly jump on board at the last minute, one thing's for sure, we better have our hearts knitted together in trust and confidence in each other. We better have this thing forked out. As you read through Yahshua's commands about how to manage the brotherhood, it's obvious he wanted a body of people that cared about each other. Okay, I want to talk about the parable of the virgins. I'm going to give you the official sacred namers interpretation of that parable, and then I'm going to derive an application of that. I do not want to take away from the main doctrine about the parable of the virgins. Remember, there was 10 virgins, 5 were wise, 5 were foolish. The 5 foolish ones didn't have enough oil in their lamp. The other 5, I forget now if the lamp was empty or if it just had insufficient oil. There was 5 wise ones that was all filled up. In classical sacred name doctrine, and I believe this, it says that that oil is explained in the Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 3. What is that oil? And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, that's the Holy Spirit. Well, they could be right. I see a better explanation there in the Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 3. Because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name, Shem, thy name is as ointment poured forth. Therefore do the virgins love thee. And there are 2 Hebrew Matthew traditions out there, the Shem Tob Hebrew Matthew and the Dutaleh Hebrew Matthew. I own a copy of both. And the word for ointment poured forth is the same word as oil in the Hebrew Matthew as it is in the Hebrew text of Solomon's Song here, chapter 1, verse 3. We say in the end time, you better have Yahweh's holy name, or you're going to miss out. Now, others may have a slightly different interpretation, but almost everybody in ministry in the sacred name network will quote this passage to explain the parable of the 10 virgins. Now, I'm going to give you another application. This is not the main interpretation, but another application. Take that word Shem, thy name is as a ointment poured forth. The Hebrew word for name is Shem. It also means reputation. Let's experiment with that a little bit and you see what happens. It also means reputation. Now, how many of you, watch, all these hands go up. I wish the camera could see it. How many of you have stuck your neck out and vouched for somebody and they later proved to be unfaithful? Said, oh, yeah, he's a good guy. He'll do a good job. Yeah, you can trust him. Yeah, he'll step up for you. I've known him for a long time. And then this guy shows up, and he makes a mess of things. And I've been embarrassed like that. I see a number of hands have gone up. This has happened to you. What happened is you took your reputation, and you imputed it to them. You shared your reputation with them, and then they made a fool out of you. And not only that, you know, their goose is cooked because they blew it on the job or they did something ill-conceived. But now your reputation is tarnished and you don't have as much of a reputation as you did prior to this debacle. If I'm allowed to make an application of this verse here, this parable, you're going to have a lot of Johnny-come-latelys before the end time, before the tribulation. They're going to come, and their lamps are going to be empty. And it's impossible to trust them. No reputation. No legacy. And one of you may be tempted to say, oh, I know him. Yeah, we play billiards on Wednesday night. He's a good guy. Yeah, he can tag along. And then he's just like that mixed multitude, the rabble in the Exodus experience. I want water. I'm used to onions and leeks. I go out for steak every. Where's the steak? I go out for steak every week. And here you've invested your reputation in this stranger, who wants the love. They want the blessings. They want the fellowship, but they don't want the disciplines that we've cultivated over the years. You know, I rejoice over the stories I heard about the hardships you had in the weather. Did it ever cross your mind that last week while you guys were hunkered down over a two-inch thick glaze of ice? Did it ever occur to you at some point that this was like a foretaste of a tribulation? You're relying on Yahweh? And I heard that you were calling each other and checking up. Yeah, I'm leaning against trusting strangers, last minute Johnny come latelys, based on the parable of the 10 virgins. They haven't built up that reputation that we can trust them. Now, maybe Yahweh will overrule this with some revelation later. But you see, I have a circle the wagons attitude about my brothers and sisters in the faith. I want my brothers and sisters protected. And how long does Yahweh have to play upon our hearts till we realize that our allegiance should be to this people, to each other, more than any other? Brother Jose is from Puerto Rico. At least that's where his ancestry is from. That brother, whose skin is a little darker than me, is more my brother than relatives in my family who look a lot like me. You know, they say blood is thicker than water. I say, yeah, the blood of Messiah is a lot thicker. Thicker than any blood. I'm going to talk about a special kind of trust. Okay, I'm going to introduce you to Yahweh, the master chess player. It came up in the discussion about in John chapter 9, Luke chapter 9, where Yahshua sent messengers out to find lodging, and they came back with nothing. And it looked like Yahshua couldn't anticipate. It would appear on the surface that Yahshua failed to anticipate that they could not find lodging. But what happened is when they couldn't find lodging, it was, help me out here, it was James and who was the other guy? James and John? James and John wanted to call fire down from heaven. This is an example of somebody who's dealing harshly with Yahweh's truth. They didn't get their way. They experienced some rejection. They want to call fire down from heaven. I'm going to talk about a particular brand of trust that you have to cultivate if you want to cultivate trust in each other. This is going to be a very difficult thing to cover. And as you try to see if Yahweh's speaking to you as he's spoken to me. One thing's for sure, it's going to happen sooner or later. How many people have experienced rebuke and the one wagging his or her bony finger in your face was rude, high-headed, impolite, loud and harsh? How many have experienced that? I'll close my eyes, just if you don't want me to know. I have been the victim of this, and I have also been the perpetrator of this. And I'd like to invite you to Yahshua as the master chess player who works through these situations. If you come to me and admonish me, and you are harsh, loud, rude, high-headed, pushy, condemning, it's something you must understand, and we'll support this with the scriptures shortly. You may very well be an instrument of Yahweh's work in my life, and I have a responsibility to trust Yahweh to work through you when you are harsh like that. But my observation, my experience in the Bible tells me that the person who willfully serves as the vessel for harsh rebuke, woe to that person who wants to be the vessel of harsh rebuke. There was some chap running around the country about, it was in the late 80s and the early 90s, not going to mention his name, but he'd been put out of several assemblies, running around, and he just visits congregations and hollers his head off, condemns them, puts them down, And he was taken aside once, and with one of the congregations I know, they took him aside and they said, you know, you're coming on real harsh. Your message is getting lost in the harshness. And he said, that's my calling. I'm meant to be this way. And it was evident that he knew he enjoyed it too much. You know, his personal life is an absolute train wreck. And you wouldn't want to go near this guy. Now, if somebody does that to me, and by the way, he did this to me. I take this as a call to holiness. When somebody comes to you, especially if most of the accusations are false, they come to you harsh, with goads, with hurting words, I find it profitable to see if there's maybe 5 or 10% of what they said is still right. Is there a biblical basis for this? My claim is that Yahweh sends me harsh messengers. Well, if there's harsh messengers in my life, I should strive to discern that Yahweh is talking to me through them, even if it's only 5 or 10% true. Secondly, woe to them. Because when it's all over, they're going to get punished for being available for such a harsh, a difficult, and evil exploit. You know, I can't find the verses now, but it's plain from the scriptures that Yahweh sent Babylon to punish Judah. But it's plain from other scriptures that it's plain from other scriptures that Babylon was treated harshly as a punishment for how harsh they were towards Judah. This is a master chess player using people's character flaws for his glory. Let's talk about Job. A lot of talk about Job. A lot of commentaries about Job. I'm not going to cover all of Job here. I believe the main message of Job was that he simply had a misunderstanding. He thought all his good works could save him. And I wouldn't even call that a sin. You know, the Bible says at the beginning of Job, it says at the end of Job, and even in the prophet Ezekiel, Job is righteous. There's no way I'm going to impute sin to Job. But he seemed to have a misunderstanding. To me, the climactic verse is in Job 40, verse 14. Yahweh says to Job, if you can bring the humble down, if you can do all the great things I did, he said, then I will confess that your own right hand can save you. It's in Job 40, verse 14. For me, that's the climactic verse. That's the lesson. But what got Job to that point where he was ready to hear that? He was smitten with these boils and his kids were killed. But there's a part of the story that baffles many, and it's these three friends that come and torment him. Job, you did something wrong. You did something to deserve this. Yahweh's just in all his ways. This happened to you for a reason. And Job is sitting there saying, I know I'm paraphrasing now, but Job is sitting there saying, all right, why did all this happen to me? I'm a good guy. I help the poor. I don't look upon girls. Citing all his good works. Why were these three friends part of the story? They were sent there to put pressure on Job, to cause him to do some self-examination. Their words were not true. If we look at Job chapter 42, verse 7, after Job and Yahweh are reconciled. Now let's see, I copy this from a translation that uses the form Jehovah. I'm sorry, it should say Yahweh for sure. And it was so that after Yahweh had spoken these words unto Job, Yahweh said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against thy two friends, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take unto you 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you. For him will I accept, that I deal not with you after your folly, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, went and did according as Yahweh commanded them, and Yahweh accepted Job. And Yahweh turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends, and Yahweh gave Job twice as much as he had before. By the way, if I slipped and said Jehovah in there somewhere, I'm sorry. I really am. So here's what happened. Part of Yahweh's scheme is for these three friends to put pressure on Job, forcing him into self-examination. Then when it's all over, they are candidates for very harsh judgment because of what they did. They were made available, candidates for this task, and now they're going to be punished for being so available, so willing to act this way. So Yahweh, the master chess player, brings out a character flaw in them as well. Now, interestingly, they don't get forgiven until Job prays for them. Now, we're supposed to learn from these examples. If you come on to me harsh, even if most of what you say is wrong, even if everything you say is wrong, I'm still going to take it as Yahweh's exclamation point for me to do some self-examination. Not only that, I have a responsibility to pray for you so Yahweh doesn't drop the hammer on you for your big mouth. Here's an obscure passage in David. Very few have the courage to crush this story to their bosom. And David, it's in 2 Samuel 16, verse 5. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth, and cursed still as he came. You know, I only have that there as a key. I'm going to have to turn there and read the rest. David is marching with his entourage, and this guy named Shimei comes out of nowhere and starts cursing him. This guy David just continues to impress me. This is David, the fallen David, the sinner, David the sinner. I'm going to continue in verse 6, this Shimei guy. And he cast stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. Yahweh hath returned upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And Yahweh hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man. Now you notice some of this is true and some of this is false. He claims the house of the blood of Saul came upon David. That's not true. That's totally irrelevant. But other parts are true, because David was a bloody man, particularly with that deal with Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittite getting murdered. Then said Abishai the son of Zeruiah unto the king, why should this dead dog curse my master the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take his head off. The king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because Yahweh hath said unto him, curse David. Who shall then say, wherefore hast thou done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son, which came forth from my bowels, seeks my life. He's talking about Absalom. How much more now may this Benjamite do it? Let him alone and curse him, for Yahweh hath bidden him. When we have someone throwing stones at us, sometimes true, sometimes false accusations, which of us has the courage to look back and say, I probably deserve more than this? Which of us has the courage to trust Yahweh working through that harsh, big-mouthed brother, or even a stranger, and say, there's some truth in there. I got to go back and sort this out. Here's some neat tips for how to handle situations in the world. Somebody's insulting you or accusing you. I find it very effective to say things like, thanks, I needed that. Or, you could be right. I'd like to think about that. Joseph and his brothers. There's more to Shimei, but I think in the interest of time, I should press on. Joseph and his brothers. Joseph was lacking in discipline, a big mouth. Hey, I had a dream. Your stalks of grain were worshiping mine. I had a dream. Your stars were worshiping mine. You know, big mouth. And his father's pampering and powdering him and giving him a coat of many colors. Big mouth. A great way to earn trust within the brotherhood. His brothers were fed up with this, but they dealt with it in a harsh way. They sold him into slavery. And that was a very cruel and wicked way to deal with their brother. Now, Yahweh, the master chess player, he takes Joseph and sends him into Egyptian slavery to set the stage for a great deliverance later. But he also learned discipline. He learned how to handle money. He learned how to handle people. He learned how to relate to people. He learned how to be under authority. He learned how to have authority. He could have never learned this being pampered and powdered by his father. There's no way. So Yahweh works through the harshness of those men, sends Joseph into Egypt. Now, when they come to visit Joseph looking for grain in Genesis 42, there's been estimates on this, like 20, 30 years have gone by. And these guys have got a new ulcer every night. And when Joseph, he hasn't revealed himself. He says, you mentioned a younger brother. He says, you're going to bring that kid here next time or I'm going to know you guys are liars. Now, they don't know it's Joseph saying that. And then they turned one to another and they said, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, and that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. Their consciences tormented them for 20, 30 years. And when this terrible thing happens, where you know, Joseph demands that, you know, they're gonna be known as liars if they don't bring their little Benjamin brother back. They know this happened to them as a punishment from Yahweh. My point is, if you deal harshly with me or each other, you are going to regret it deeply. I have when I've played that role. I see it in the scripture. In Matthew 7, Yahshua says, judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. And with what measure you meet, it shall be measured unto you again. There's no lack of people in this earth who are anxious to judge and judge harshly. They're all over the place. I just don't think we should traffic in that kind of business. It's not in my notes, but it's easy to turn to Galatians. Come on, if somebody needs to be straightened out, it's probably going to happen a lot between now and the end time. Galatians tells us there, yeah, it's in chapter 6. Brethren, if a man... Verse 1, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in a spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Supposed to do this stuff in a spirit of meekness. I'm going to transition now to modern ways of earning mistrust. In terms of earning trust, I think it's kind of obvious we should have good fruits, work at manifesting good fruits, do everything we can out into the open. There's some modern ways of earning mistrust I wanted to touch upon because they are peculiar to our age and to our culture. Again, I can't cover the whole subject here, but this is stuff we should be particularly aware of and look out for. One thing is software piracy. Software piracy is altogether too common. Every scrap of software on your machine has got to be licensed. If it's not licensed, it's stolen. There's a thing called shareware where you're allowed to try it for a trial period. That's okay. And I got a software program I love called XY Math. An engineer told me about it on an airplane about 20 years ago. I tried sending a check there and it came back. You can't pay for it anymore. That's the only piece of software on my computer that's not licensed. It's a 25-year-old DOS program. And I can't find the guy to give him a check. So, okay, but what about your computer? It's very easy to just copy CDs and pass them around. In fact, I failed to mention music. Got lots of downloaded music on my computer. All clean songs. You can come by. There's a lot of lovely clean songs out there of good report, very edifying stuff. It's all clean, and it's all paid for. There's one song I thought a friend of mine would like. It was kind of a novelty gag song from the past. I copied it on a CD, I gave it to him, and I erased it from my hard drive. So in a sense, I transferred the license to him. What about you? If I call that 800 number on you, and the cops come out and check your computers, will you bring Yahweh's name to shame? It's so easy to copy this stuff. Rebellion. Our culture is a rebellious kind of culture. We are encouraged to do civil disobedience. What is the greatest example of faith in the Bible, though? The greatest example of faith in the New Testament is a pagan soldier who understood authority, and he was rewarded with a healing for his master. What about you? Are you having a hard time obeying the civil authorities? You know, if I'm connected with you in a tribulation environment, and you are in the practice of civil disobedience, you increase my risk. Because they're coming after you. If you're into some, I'm going to make a statement, this is the mountain I'm going to die on, and then I may wind up dying with you. If you are into civil disobedience, it hinders my ability to trust you. I'd like you to think about that. How about outstanding debt? This culture encourages debt. Get it now. Have it now. We should be saving up for the things we need, just as we take the time to save up a good reputation. Proverbs 22, verse 7 says that the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. If you're accumulating debt, you are now, part of your life is owned by some outsider. I want to be careful how I say this. There's a word going around of a brother in the faith, a brother of goodwill, who's been building bunkers and things in the basement of his house to house brethren in case of a tribulation situation. My concern is, what I'd like to know, I should look the guy up, but what I'd like to know is, who owns the mortgage on the house? Because if that property is not paid for, I'm not as confident of it being a place of refuge. What, a bank? A banker owns the house? Well, there's too much risk there. You know, I would hope these sermons are an engine for self-examination and improvement. I'm reacting to some great teaching I heard at the feast from Brother Norm Hunter, encouraging us to get out of debt. Since that sermon, I've done that. And I feel like $1 million with interest. That's probably not a good way to put it. But I feel great having those credit cards paid off. I still use the card to pay for gas or online purchases, you know, but I pay the balance off right away. Here's another thing that hinders my ability to trust you. I'm not saying trust is a black and white thing, but it's a matter of closeness. How close can I draw to you? How intimate can I be with you? If you take on too much, it says in Proverbs 19:2, also that the soul be without knowledge, it is not good, and he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. If you got too much projects in your life, too much going on, what happens is you're in a hurry for everything, because you got to get a lot of stuff done in a narrow slice of time. And what happens is when you're in a hurry, you take foolish risks, and you sometimes cut corners and cheat. I'd like to bring to remembrance Luke chapter 19, verse 17, where Yahshua says, well, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. A lot of people in ministry want to be faithful over much. They're not going to be faithful over much until they're faithful over little in this life. So this is a tip for some of you guys. It's hard for me to imagine any more hardworking ministry than what I see here at YRM, but you guys got to be careful not to take on too much, because you're going to be tempted to cheat and cut corners and fudge. Okay, I'm going to summarize now everything I've covered because I'm just about done. I started with my personal quest for developing trust between me and brothers and sisters in the faith. You come to my home, you go anywhere you want. I want you to know that I trust you, and maybe you'll learn to trust me. Been working on this for a long time. If you look at the Old Testament, how it talks about trust relative to man, it casts a shadow, an unpleasant light on trusting man for things we should trust Yahweh for. And the New Testament continues this theme, talking about how we trust Yahweh for eternal life, our salvation, our well-being. But there are also verses that talk about us having trust in each other for things that seem very reasonable. Our common faith, joy in that common faith. And on a practical basis, we need to trust each other to do exploits. There's a lot of different exploits we're going to be involved with. The day's going to come when this ministry is going to expand, and you're going to look back and say, wow, those were wonderful days when we just started out. You're going to look back fondly at this time when Yahweh was preparing us. I'm saying that the mortar between the bricks of what we're building is a mortar made of trust. Projects, evangelism, volunteer night at YRM, it doesn't matter. But we're all building up for the big exploit that's coming in the end time, and we'll be teaching righteousness to many, and we'll be in the line of fire, because there's likely going to be some authorities out there who don't like us. When we get into that high octane situation, we've got to look back at this era and say, yeah, this is where we earned each other's trust. The question must be answered as to how we can extend that trust to strangers who come in late. I don't have the answer, but I lean against taking risk there. And finally, I invest a lot of time in a special kind of trust where if let's say I come to you and I'm harsh in tone, judgmental, rude, condemning, you should still try to find value in what I say, but Yahweh is going to give me one honey of a spanking. And I don't want to play that role. I don't want to see any of you guys do that. As it says in Galatians, let us restore one another gently. We've already pushed the button that says no more sin. We've already pushed the button that says I want to be holy. We've already made that choice. So let's provoke one another to good works. Thank you very much, friends. It was my pleasure to see you all from up here and to share this with you. Every blessing of Yahweh be upon you now.